Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Tuesday, Thursday morning. It's July 10th. Currently 63 degrees here in Old Town Park City. 67 degrees in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Thursday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your Thursday forecast for the Wasatch Back. We're looking at lots of sunshine as a weak front moves by to our north. That's going to bring in some breezy and slightly cooler temperatures across the area. So high temperatures for us today in Park City, only climbing to around 80 degrees for your daytime high. The Heber Valley, we're going to be cooler as well with lots of sunshine. Temperatures only climbing into the upper 80s for highs as we move throughout your Thursday afternoon. Going into your Friday, we're looking at lots of sunshine. We'll kick off the day in the 40s. In the Heber Valley, with temperatures down into the low 50s there in Park City, and high temperatures during the afternoon will remain somewhat on the cooler side, with highs only in the lower 80s for your Friday afternoon in Park City, and highs only around 90 in the Heber Valley. How about the weekend forecast? We've got lots of sunshine for you in both Park City and in the Heber Valley. On your Saturday, we're looking at temperatures starting off in the low 50s there in Park City, climbing into the mid 80s in the afternoon hours. We'll start off in the upper 40s in the Heber Valley once again, but we rebound into the low 90s by the afternoon hours for us. So the warming trend will begin heading into your Sunday. We're looking at those temperatures starting off into the 50s, and we'll see our high temperatures in Park City climbing back to the upper 80s for highs. Meanwhile, the Heber Valley will see those high temperatures jumping into the mid 90s across the area. The new work week will start off with warm and sunny conditions out there across the region. Temperatures kicking off on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday mornings in the 50s, but by the afternoon hours on Monday, we're going to be looking at those high temperatures right around 90 degrees in Park City. We'll stick with those highs right around 90 for your Tuesday, right on into your Wednesday as well. Meanwhile, the Heber Valley, we're looking at high temperatures in the mid-90s, and we'll stick with those mid-90s not only for your Monday afternoon, but for your Tuesday and Wednesday afternoons as well. So it looks like a lot of heat and pretty much slim to no rain chances over the next 7 days. That's your latest forecast from the ABC Forecast Center. I'm meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Stay tuned in just a minute. We'll be checking in with our trails report, but coming up, I'll also be talking with Summit County Council member Megan McKenna, local historians and train enthusiast David Nicholas, and Sandra Morrison with details on the lecture this Saturday, End of the Line, happening at the Historic Echo Church, and from Park City Film Executive Director Katie Wang with a look at some upcoming screenings and her request to expand the number of annual screenings. Right now on the phone with us with our weekly trails report from Mountain Trails Foundation, it's Rick Fournier. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning, Leslie, and good morning, Park City. First off, a few closures and trail impacts to be aware of. Closures remain in effect at Park City Mountain on Lower Jennies and Seldom Seen first-time return. For your safety, please respect all closures and use the suggested alternative routes that are posted at the base area. Basin Recreation reports that the 29029 trail race is running today through Saturday. Expect increased trail congestion as runners complete a series of courses throughout the Mid-Mountain and Robs trail systems, including Ironville and Moose Pedal, starting and ending at the canyons each day. Trails will remain open to the public, but consider alternative routes to avoid crowds. They also wanted to mention that they are seal coating several of our commuter pathways today through Saturday. There will be 24-hour closures on those pathways once applied. You can see a map on their social media posts. Trails impacted include the Millennium Trail from Olympic Parkway to Bear Hollow, Basin Express, Old Ranch Road, Split Rail Pathway, and East 224 behind Fox Point and the Fieldhouse. Wasatch Trails wanted to let folks know that they have a dig day this Saturday and will be working on the hike-only section of the Bonanza to Wow Connector. They will be meeting at the top of the Wow Trail at 9 a.m. The big news this week is that starting on Friday, Park City Transit's Purple Route is expanding to offer regular, reliable access to Bonanza Flat, to the Bonanza Flat and Bloods Lake trailheads through a new summer-fall trail service. This updated service replaces the former Transit to Trails program and supports a more sustainable car-free way to reach some of Park City's high-elevation trails and open space. Details on that include trail service running Friday through Saturday, 20-minute frequency from Old Town, from the Old Town Transit Center to Bloods Lake Trailhead and the Bonanza Flat Trailhead, including regular Purple Route, standard stops at the Montage, et cetera. They will also continue their regular service Monday through Thursday, 30-minute frequency to the Montage with standard Purple stops. Operating hours are 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. daily. Dogs are now welcome on all of the Park City transit routes with leash and muzzle in designated area on the bus. Buses can accommodate 8 bikes per trip. During the trail service, they've added some great new racks that'll accommodate more bikes, which is awesome. Rain dances are strongly encouraged, and have a great one out there.
Okay, Rick. Hey, thanks for the update. In the studio now with an update from yesterday's Summit County Council meeting, I have Council Member Megan McKenna. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie, and good morning to all your listeners.
Yeah, so let's start with the fact that you did have some technical difficulties yesterday with the Zoom feed for remote online viewers who are not in the council chambers in Colville. As a result, the council pushed most of the agenda to next week. And is that just because you had posted the meeting as via Zoom and couldn't deliver, so needed to, I guess, honor that so that if anybody was interested in joining by Zoom, that they would have the opportunity?
That's correct. And we actually had one of our interviews was scheduled to be online. And so what we ended up doing is moving a portion of the meeting into the conference room. And so we were still able to hold our interviews, but the decision was made to postpone the other stuff that could wait.
Okay. Do you have any idea what happened?
It sounds like there was a missing adapter for the audio. So, it was unfortunate, but you know these things happen, and our IT department is great, and Brian moved quickly, and we just adjust as need be.
Yeah. Now this is something these online meetings that the county council and other public bodies didn't have to do before COVID. It was COVID that kind of we figured out a way to stream meetings online. Is that the primary way people attend meetings nowadays? Do you have any idea?
I think it depends what's on the agenda, but I think so. It seems like we often have more folks following online than in person. And we also had two of our council members online last night. So that's, also helpful for busy staff and council as well.
All right, so they didn't actually, they were not part of the interview process since they weren't there.
They were. So we were still able to hold the interviews in the conference room. So we had audio capability there, just weren't able to open it up, for the full meeting. But they were able to participate as well as our online interview.
Now, does state law require an online option? Do you know?
I don't think it requires it, but I think it does have to be posted if it is.
Yeah. What's your sense? Is it an overall positive or negative for public engagement?
I think it's positive. I think it opened it up for more folks to be able to attend and to stay engaged. It's definitely changed the format, I would say. But I think overall it's a positive for the community, for the public, just to stay informed and to be able to participate with greater flexibility.
Yeah. Do you in terms of people making comments to the council, do they tend to show up as opposed to doing it online or?
Yeah, I think public comment, people do still tend to show up in person, especially for some of the bigger, more debated topics. I think in person, it still seems to be more impactful.
Okay, and as you mentioned, one of the things you were able to do yesterday was to interview the three applicants for two openings on High Valley Transit's Board of Trustees. Bob Zanetti and Peter Tamai, well known around town. Zanetti for his time, of course, as Park City Fire Chief. Tamai for consulting on major developments. Zev Rosenfeld, less a household name. What was on his resume?
I just want to say all three candidates were really highly qualified, and once again, the council was tasked with a really tough decision. Zev was spent most of his life here in Summit County. He went to Wileman School, and his background is in hospitality. And I think he would have brought a really important perspective to High Valley Transit, along with Bob and Peter. But of course, we only have two seats available. And just like everyone that applies, I would encourage Zev to continue to stay engaged and to apply again. I wish we had three seats. All of us were saying that, how impressed we were with all of the candidates.
All right, so council did make a decision.
We did make a decision, yeah. As you mentioned, Peter and Bob Zanetti were both appointed to seat 6 and seat 7 of the High Valley Transit Board of Trustees. So it'll now be a 7-member board.
Okay. Can you give us an update where the transit district is headed next, besides that bus rapid transit project?
Well, that's certainly a big one. They did just move into the new transit campus, which was really exciting, just a couple of weeks ago. The housing, the apartments upstairs will be occupied shortly, so that's really exciting too. But yeah, I think the bus rapid transit is really kind of the big project that's been in the works. We're continuing to work with our partners on that in the design process, and we'll start to see early construction later this summer.
Okay, so once BRT is implemented, what's the current board's vision kind of going forward? I think you sit on the board, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yep, I am one of the council members on the board, along with Chris Robinson and Candace Hart. And I think the vision going forward is just to continue to increase ridership and to expand regionally and just to, to continue to reach more residents along the Wasatch Back.
Yeah, any new developments with regard to Wasatch County?
I think their ridership was shown to be really successful, and along with microtransit down in Wasatch County, and so I think that program those routes will continue to expand, and I think we'll just continue to see more and more on that side of the Wasatch Back.
Okay, let's see. The council was required to set the certified tax rates this week. And that's to make sure that the county doesn't overcharge or undercharge residents, and you're supposed to collect the same amount of money each year unless you go through a public hearing process, and so you adjust the rate based on property values. Were you able then to take the business of setting that tax rate?
That was one of the items that we did choose to do there in the conference room. Cindy Key is our Summit County auditor. As you know, she's our elected, essentially county watchdog for all things financial, right? She, in addition to preparing our annual budget and the annual audit, she certifies the tax rate. And so we were tasked with ratifying that last night. And it's a tricky one for people to understand, but essentially you're taking your prior year taxes, property taxes, over the current assessed property value, minus any new growth. And this is all part of the Utah certified rate law, which equalizes the revenue annually. So it's a little confusing, I think, for some people to wrap their heads around, but it really just helps to equalize the tax rate. And so last night we looked at the different taxing entities and just certified their rate. Most stayed fairly close to the same.
Okay. The Dakota Pacific Project got a positive recommendation at the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission meeting this week. The company, proceeding under the state law that seems to give them the right to build, passed after residents had petitioned for a referendum on the first development agreement that the council approved back in December. One of the planning commissioners, Matt Nagy, had asked the developer what this means for the role of referendums, presumably more broadly in Utah. County legal counsel cut off the conversation, but how would you answer that question?
I think it didn't really make sense for that conversation in terms of the Planning Commission and what they were tasked to do. But I think it is an important conversation to have. I think there's probably a lot of questions. There's a lot of confusion about the topic. And so I think, you know, I would just say that at this stage, Dakota Pacific is pursuing their administrative approval that they were allowed through the Senate Bill 26 that you mentioned. And that is what the Planning Commission was tasked with last night, was basically just certifying that they meet the requirements for Senate Bill 26, and that it does qualify for administrative approval. In terms of the referendum, at this point, it really is kind of a moot point because they've pursued this alternate option. But I think it does still, I think it's important for the community to know that the referendum, while the signatures were not certified, and now, as you know, five residents are suing the clerk's office, it's how I guess to clarify, I mean, I didn't support the referendum, but I absolutely support the process of a referendum, and I think it's really important, and I think that is where the county sits in this, and I think the clerk did her job to the best of her ability, and it's really disappointing that this is the route that it's taken. I think the county certainly takes this, you know, very seriously, and it's unfortunate, and I think this is why the council made the decision that they did back in December. That was before I was on the council, but they knew if they didn't come to an agreement that the developer was likely to go to a legislative fix, which is what they did in this case.
Yeah. Given that, though, I guess it's like in any other matter, a lawsuit would actually stop the process until that could be decided. But it sounds like it doesn't matter in this case because of the Senate Bill 26.
Yeah, I mean, that is the, I think that's the frustration, you know, with all of us is in Senate Bill 26, it made it pretty clear that the process couldn't be stopped at that point.
So it sounds like that might be part of the challenge, or do we know yet?
That we don't know.
Also, you were involved in the House Bill 267 public union bill referendum effort. Does the state potentially overriding a local referendum make you nervous about what happens next legislative session with public union bargaining?
Yeah, it certainly does, and that's why I mentioned, you know, that I think the referendum process is a really important tool to have in our democracy, and something especially is that we saw, I think, in House Bill 267 is a perfect example of why we need to have those tools at our disposal. And when we see things like with what's happening with the referendum in the case of Dakota Pacific, I think it makes us really nervous that the legislature will retaliate. They've already made it so difficult to file a referendum and to get something on the ballot. And that's really where I think the issue and where a lot of the confusion came in with the referendum for Dakota Pacific. Many said it was, you know, just a technicality, but really that is the law, and that is what is put in place. And really it's to protect us, to protect the voters, and to make sure that we're represented. But these some of these rules, you know, are designed to make it really difficult, because that is the process we have. We can't put everything on the ballot. We have a representative democracy. We elect people to hopefully represent us. And if that doesn't feel like that's what's happening, and then this, you know, should be a tool that we have, and that would be a shame for that to go away. Especially if, you know, for lawsuits or other reasons.
All right. A couple of the items that were pushed back to next week include the High Ute Ranch Trail easement with Basin Recreation, and then the Central Wasatch Commission to admit Holiday into the commission was pushed back as well. But just real quick, we got a couple minutes here. You were a participant on City Tour earlier this spring, Lake Tahoe, Truckee, and Reno. What were your impressions out of that?
Oh, it was so great, Leslie. As you know, we went on City Tour together. It's such an excellent opportunity to see what other communities are doing. I would say that the take home in Tahoe by far is collaboration. I mean, the number of state and local organizations that had to come together to protect that lake is really impressive, especially given some of the constraints that California has in terms of building and development and environmental regulations. It makes it seem really easy here in Utah to get anything done. And so just really impressive, the collaborative efforts that we saw from Truckee to Tahoe to Reno. We also got the opportunity to ride their bus rapid transit in Reno, which was really cool to actually see it in work. I know Connor from KPCW here got to check out the bus rapid transit up in Ogden, and it really is impressive when you get to see it firsthand. So that was really exciting. But I think really my favorite part of the whole thing is just getting to know some of our local leaders and some of my colleagues and this new leadership class. It's such a great program and just what a great opportunity to get to know local leaders.
All right. And applications for Class 32 are available, as well as the leadership class in the Heber Valley as well. And finally, I just wanted to ask you, Summit County Fair coming up next month. Any plans for the council to participate?
Yeah, there are so many opportunities for the council and for the community to participate, and I'm glad you brought it up, because I was going to mention it too. Tyler Orgill has done an amazing job again organizing our Summit County Fair, and I would just encourage everyone to look it up. It'll be the first week of August. There's a lot of new sustainability efforts this time around, which I'm really excited about. I'll be going to the rodeo and the demolition derby, a senior luncheon, and there's so many different opportunities to participate. I'm really looking forward to the music too, and of course the fair.
Okay, anything else you wanted to mention?
You know, I would just like to say thanks to the chamber for throwing a really great barbecue last week, and for the town of Oakley and the Oakley Rodeo that we got to participate in. The 4th of July parade, I got to participate here in Park City, and so Park City Municipal always puts on a really great 4th of July celebration. And so thanks to everyone, and as you heard earlier this week, our local law enforcement certainly had a busy weekend. So thanks to them for keeping us all safe. And I hope everyone had a really great Independence Day weekend.
Okay. Megan McKenna, a member of the Summit County Council, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
Historic Echo Church hosting another lecture this Saturday. In the studio to tell us more, I have Sandra Morrison, a board member of the Echo Board of Trustees, and local historian David Nichols. Nicholas, good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning.
Sandra, let's start with you, and you can just tell us where the church is located, how people find it.
So the church is about 30 miles from Park City on Interstate 80. In fact, it's right, if you head towards Wyoming, it's right where Interstate 80 and 84 divide. So it's exit 169. and then you just follow the frontage road into town underneath the Red Cliffs. It's just a really cute town, historic. First settled in the 1850s, and then of course the Transcontinental Railroad showed up in 1869, you know, linking the country, and so it boomed after that. Big railroad town, had coal chutes, water, all the steam engines that came up from Ogden would use a whole load of coal and, you know, run their tanks dry and would have to get refueled there. And then also, because the grade was even steeper getting from Echo up to Evanston, Wyoming, they would attach helper engines in Echo, and so there was a roundhouse there with additional engines, and so that lasted, you know, right through you know, the Second World War era, and then the Union Pacific started converting to diesel, and they're a lot stronger engines, and of course didn't need the helper engines, didn't need the water, didn't need the coal, and so the town has yeah, it's pretty well preserved in the sort of 1960s with a lot of historic buildings. The church was built in 1876, and so it's going to be 150 years old next year. Yeah, and in preparation of that, we're getting the outside painted. I just talked to the painters this morning, and they said they're about halfway done. So getting spruced up.
David, you've spent years researching local history. What's your story? I mean, what draws you to this region's past?
Well, you know, it's just a fascinating history, as we all know. You know, the fact that mining operated here for 112 years, you could have four generations of people who worked in the mines, and also the fact that you had rail service into town for 108 years. I mean, that to me, that just blows my mind, and I never tire of doing research as it relates to Park City's history.
All right, so what inspired you to this particular lecture? What's the story behind End of the Line?
Yeah, a couple things on that, Leslie. First of all, my research partner, Stu Stanek, sends his best regards to you and to your listeners. He's in Colorado attending one of his grandchild's birthdays. So, but Stu will be back in time for our lecture on Saturday. There's one other point I want to make. We have two lectures, actually, in the next week. We have this one at 4 p.m. on Saturday in Echo, with an Echo orientation. And then on Wednesday, July 16th at 5 p.m. at the Park City Museum's Education and Collection Center at 2079 Sidewinder Drive, we have a Park City version of the lecture.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Well, so without giving away too much, I mean, what are some of the key themes that you're going to present in End of the Line?
Yeah, Stu and I are going to look at the changes in the Park City economy from early 1950s through the 1980s, and the attempts to develop a resort industry, diversify the town's economy, but also revive the mines, too. You know, there's a lot of attention paid to the resort development beginning in 1963 with Treasure Mountain. But what's interesting, Leslie, for easy math, let's say $25 million was spent from 1963 to 1982 to develop the skiing industry here, and double that amount was spent to revive and modernize the mines in Park City. And we also have, Stu will be talking about the influence of the Hunt brothers and their impact on Park City with their multi-year effort to corner the global silver market. So it's really a fun thing. And then a couple other things. When it was announced, when Union Pacific announced in January of 1986 their intention to abandon and or sell their Park City spur, there were a variety of entities interested in preserving the spur. One of them was a combined effort by Wasatch County, Summit County, and Utah County. They created the Tri-County Rail Commission, and they had a vision to link Echo, Park City, all the towns in between, connect to Heber, to the Heber Valley or Heber Creeper Railroad, have a station at Sundance, and reconnect to Provo. It would have been a 67-mile long short line, mixed use, commuter, tourist, and industry. Unfortunately, they weren't able to raise the funding for that. And in kind of a panic, there were a group of extraordinary people that came together in Park City's history, including Brad Olch, Miles Radiman, Sally Elliott, Jennifer Harrington, and Marianne Cohn. And those people, along with others, had this vision of the importance of preserving the right-of-way and the property associated with it, which was 31 miles and a little over 400 acres. And they combined together to apply to the Federal Rail Bank Program. And this, and what was the Park City Spur in 1992, became the first rail trail in Utah's history.
Yeah. Talk a little bit also just the broader history of transportation. I mean, this, without the rail line, there certainly wouldn't have been a mining.
Sorry. Well, they needed each other, you know, to survive. I mean, yeah, there was war here, but it was, I don't want to say worthless, but without a way, as Sandra mentioned, to get it to the regional and national and global markets, Park City would never have become a boom town and, you know, over a century old ski town. And the fact that the Transcontinental Railroad came through Echo in 1869 was, you know, like a godsend in some ways for the development of the mining industry here. So they really needed each other. So without one, you're not going to have the other. And passenger business was never a big entity here. By the early 1950s, it was essentially over. Yes, you had the resurrection of the annual Snowball Express in the 1960s, but that last ran on February 27th, 1971. And Union Pacific, you know, continued to serve Park City. Not so much the mines in town, but the phosphate reload center that was out by, I think it's Builders First or something like that, right near the entrance to Browns Canyon Road. And that was a, you know, big facility for Chevron Chemical from 1965 to 1986. But that represented 90% of the business on the line. So it's kind of a one-trick pony. The trick goes away. And Chevron announced in January of 1986 that they would be closing that facility. And within weeks afterwards, Union Pacific announced their intention to abandon the line or sell it.
Okay, which is why we've got the rail trail today.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, at least between Park City and Echo, but
yes.
not south to Provo.
Right.
Portions of the railroad grade still exist and are above the water of Jordanelle Reservoir. And so, you know, every so often that comes up as a discussion about creating, you know, a rail trail on that, those pieces that still exist today.
Yeah. Why do you think it's important for the community to kind of engage with this type of history today?
Well, it's what makes Park City such a unique community to live in. It is this rich history associated with its past, you know, mining, mineral extraction, you know, the development of skiing here, the connection to, I like to compare it to Ketchum, Idaho. You know, here you had their mining industry kind of peter out in the 1890s. They didn't have the ore reserves we had. And yet, Ketchum in 1936 becomes the beacon for what Park City's future is going to be with the development of the Sun Valley Resort by the Union Pacific Railroad, as you know. And Union Pacific owned Sun Valley until 1964. And, you know, from minutes associated with United Park City Mines board meetings beginning in the 1950s, they pointed to Ketchum, Idaho and the success of Sun Valley as something that needed to be duplicated here or could be duplicated here. And I believe we've talked in the past about a consultant that Averill Harriman, the chairman and CEO of Union Pacific, hired in the mid-1930s to help him find Shangri-La for skiing in North America. And this Count Felix von Schafgotz, he came here before he went to Ketchum, Idaho. And Mel Fletcher, a 16-year-old high school student, locally famous, gave him a tour. And upon leaving, Count Felix said to the town, Mel and others, yes, you have the potential, but you got to get rid of mining. And they were like, no way. So anyway, I just, like I said, I can't get enough of our town's history.
Yeah. But I think the other piece of it, though, is that it's bigger than just a Park City story when you start talking about railroads. It's a Summit County story, and especially northern Summit County story, because, you know, we're talking about not only is there ore coming out of Park City, but the mines in Colville are supplying the fuel to keep those mines operating. So, you know, it's not just a one-way trip. It's industry across the county, and of course, you know, we're also talking about lumber coming in, and, you know, supplies, and, you know, just in general food to feed people, because that was all happening, you know, out in the rural areas of the county, yeah, and that's all coming into town as well.
Okay, so again, this is happening Saturday, 4 p.m. at the Historic Echo Church,
yes.
In Echo. Any future talks or events planned?
Yes, and so the church is open every Saturday from 11 till 4, so do, you know, plan on coming out earlier, if you know, an hour or two earlier, and you can tour the church. We have a traveling exhibition on display right now about immigration, and I've added to that with some immigrants that came to Summit County, some of them on the train. Some of them walked the planes too before the train showed up. And also we have downstairs interpretation about Echo's importance, not only as a Hell on Wheels railroad town, but also, you know, with the pioneers that came through, and hunters and trappers and mountain men, and yeah, a lot of history in Echo Stagecoach. Yeah. The next lecture is August 30th, and it's another Park City Echo connection with Patsy Coughlin, who was stole strawberries, which wasn't that big of a crime, but then stole some horses and proceeded to be chased across the county. And he ended up allegedly killing the constable in Echo, Thomas Stagg, who I think was probably the first law enforcement agent in Summit County to be killed, and he's buried in the Echo Cemetery. So we actually have an attorney who's writing a book about the proceeds from the trial. Patsy Coughlin eventually gets executed by firing squad. So that'll
okay.
be
okay. That's in August.
Yeah.
Okay, but again, this Saturday, David Nicholas and Stuart Stanek presenting End of the Line, recounting the story of the Union Pacific's decision to end service between Echo and Park City. Sandra, David, thanks so much for
Thank
your
you.
Time this
Thank
morning.
Thank you.
On the phone now with an update from Park City Film, I have Executive Director Katie Wang. Good morning, Katie.
Good morning, Leslie. Great to be here.
Yeah, so even though it's kind of your dark season, you've got actually a handful of films coming up. Tell us about those.
Yes, so we're continuing our outdoor film series. This is part of our Family Film Fest series, so films that will appeal to film lovers of all ages, and we'll be out on the Park City Library patio this Friday with Paddington in Peru. We're going to be starting at dusk, so about 8:45 p.m., and we'll get to see the adventures of Paddington and the Brown family as they head into the jungles of the Amazon to find Aunt Lucy, who's gone missing from the home for retired bears. We're partnering with Park City Library and Basin Recreation on this particular screening, and admission and popcorn are free. Definitely bring a blanket or a low back chair. I think people know that drill for outdoor events. We'll be right on the patio right outside the library there. So that'll be fun. And then we're back again on Saturday, July 26th. And this time we'll be at the Colville Fairgrounds, or just kind of right next to it, with The Day the Earth Blew Up, a Looney Tunes movie. This is featuring Daffy Duck and Porky Pig as they try to save the world from an evil alien. Free food trucks starting at 5:30 p.m. And the film will start at 7 p.m. because we're using an LED screen out there so we can start before dark, which is always fun. And we'll be partnering with Summit County Health Department with additional support from the Park City Chamber on that screening. So admission is free, food is free. Come bring your family, make it a night out that the whole family can enjoy. So yeah, so that's kind of what we've got coming up for this month, and then a couple more things in August that I'll be back to talk about. But yeah, it's been a fun summer so far, and as you said, it's kind of our lighter season, but we're hoping to change that. We're in some conversations with the city right now.
Okay,
about that,
Before we jump into that, though, yep. where's the film shown in Colville, you said?
So the Colville Fairgrounds, if you know where the Ledges Event Center is, and just across the street are the Colville Fairgrounds and the Rodeo Grounds. So they've just redid the whole, the grassy area over there. It looks beautiful. So kind of that space in between them. So you can park. There's a parking lot right there. That's where the food trucks will be. And then there's just this beautiful grassy area that'll be shaded in the beginning. And then, of course, the sun will go down and it'll all be shaded. But yeah, so if you go to the Colville Fairgrounds, it's on our website what the particular address is at parkcityfilm.org. So you can just stick that in your GPS. But a great way to get out into Eastern Summit County, as we've been doing the past few summers. And we were in Hoytsville a couple weeks ago and had a huge turnout for that film, Pete's Dragon with Robert Redford. And so it's just great to be back on the eastern side of Summit County and engaging with the community over there.
Okay. And again, people just bring blankets and chairs are welcome.
Yep, exactly. Okay. And when you're in Colville, I mean, it's such a huge space. It doesn't really matter what size chair, as long as, you know, you're kind of being respectful of the people around you. But yeah, it's a great area for a film.
Okay. As you mentioned, you have made a request to Park City Municipal for increased screenings at the Jim Santee Auditorium. Maybe start by telling us, why was a cap put on the number of screenings in the first place?
You know, good question. Kind of a long-ish story that I will make short. So back in 1995, when the city renovated the Jim Santee Auditorium and Sundance came in to do the screenings, part of the development and the conditional use for that building was that they always wanted the auditorium, and this is where the Jim Santee Auditorium is still the original auditorium for that building, built in 1928. Nice historical fact there, since you just had the Historical Society. But they wanted to make sure that it was used by the community, but not ever becoming a commercial entity. So they said, yes, we'll allow screenings, film screenings in here, because that was, you know, a major interest from the community at that time. But we don't want this to become a commercial theater, so we'll cap the number of screenings one can do in this space. Anyone who's been in that space, particularly before the renovation, you know, 10 years ago, knows that there's no possibility of that ever being a commercial theater. So it's kind of interesting that they were concerned about that, just as a pop-up event, not really logistically possible. But anyway, so it was originally 80. Then under Frank Normile, they got to, I think, 100 maybe. And then since I've been on board, we got up to 130 at our last lease renewal, which is about 4 years ago. And now we are requesting from the city that we go up to 200 screenings per year. And we're asking now, before our lease renews, because, of course, as everyone knows, the Sundance Film Festival will be leaving us next year. And we feel it's important for us to prepare for that departure now, and to start amplifying our programming, expanding our partnerships, you know, really ramping up what we do, and also to have visibility on the future so we can plan for things like next summer, because we're restricted. Part of our lease also restricts us to only screening films from September through June. And then in the summer months, we were allowed, as part of our lease, one in July, one in August, unless we go in front of council and ask for special permission, which we've done over time. But it's, you know, it's kind of a big hoop to jump through every year. So really what we're asking for is more screenings and to be able to program 12 months of the year. You know, this creates a lot of opportunity for us to make up for Sundance, not just culturally, but also financially. And so you know, we're pretty excited to be able to bring that conversation to City Council tonight.
Okay, and you think you've got plenty of films out there to screen then, to fill the calendar?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's no shortage of films, and, you know, to make it, and really what the opportunity is, you know, we've always worked in partnerships. Last year we had 47 partnerships, 47 different nonprofits that we worked with. So to really lean into that a little more, I think, you know, the power of what we do is now, you know, we're the only movie theater in town. We're the only independent movie theater in, you know, the Wasatch and Summit County. And with Sundance leaving, to really lean into independent storytelling, bringing in filmmakers, amplifying the post-film conversations that people love so much at Sundance, and certainly when we do it at Park City Film. So it's also that opportunity to bring in, you know, individual, you know, one-night screenings that, like we do in our typically on a Thursday evening, and really amplifying the programming around that and engaging people through the art of independent storytelling, but also creating a platform for engaged dialogue, you know, exploring new ideas, kind of engaging us with the rest of the world and you know, things that are happening that maybe are tangential to what's happening in Park City, or we maybe think that because we live in our little bubble. But, you know, we are people of the world, and it's always empowering to see other people's stories and see how they connect to us. Maybe they reflect our own stories, or they introduce us to totally new stories that we had no idea existed until we saw the story. I mean, again, that's kind of what I think everyone loves about Sundance, is that exposure to new ideas. But so what we're envisioning is more of those, a little bit more of those one-off screenings, but then in the summer months, which again, we're not really typically programming except for outside, maybe doing something a little bit more regular. A couple of years ago, we did the Studio Ghibli Film Festival, which was five films, and we had to get special exception for that. But it was, you know, incredibly successful. People loved that. So it's not always films that are coming up that are new, but maybe kind of on a particular theme, right? Some repertory films. But again, it gives us just the ability to be more creative and really to build off that legacy that Sundance is leaving us.
Okay, so many of those free, those screenings that you partner with are free screenings. So can you afford to do more of those?
Well, that's how we get grants. So, you know, one, we sell concessions, so that certainly helps. The community partners that we work with, you know, they also contribute to the cost of the screening, to the licensing fees that we have to pay for the films, which is always helpful. So we do make sure that there is, you know, there's kind of a financial model built into that to make it more sustainable. But most of the grants that we receive are really supportive of those types of films. And so in large part, that's what we're getting grant funding for. So it's easier to raise money for those special screenings than it is just kind of, you know, no one wants to pay for pencils, but you still need to pay your bills and pay your staff. But again, it's just the amplification. And then, of course, it increases the value of the organization to the community. That helps us with memberships, which have been increasing, you know, exponentially over the past couple of years. As soon as Sundance announced their departure, I mean, it was unbelievable. It's like it makes me, you know, brings tears to my eyes almost. But, you know, people just came up and they immediately said, how can we help? What do we need to do? We need to step up. Please don't go away. It's like, no, absolutely not. It's the opposite. I mean, now it's more important than ever. You know, our mission to create community through film, like we're the only ones left, right? Once Sundance leaves, we're it. So, you know, we really take that seriously. We were started because of Sundance in 95, the Park City Film. And, you know, we know our community wants us here and, you know, really appreciates what we bring to the community. So, you know, really leaning into that. And so we're looking at, you know, again, this amplification that it will kind of be self-generating. And that's, so that's what we're hoping to do with all of this. But it's, you know, it's slow steps, right? It's, that's where we're starting now so that we can ramp up. And then when Sundance leave, kind of ride that last wave out into the next, whatever the next iteration will be. And we're certainly talking to other arts organizations. I mean, it's not just us. But how do we as a collective in our community, as the nonprofit community, the arts community, really make up for that cultural gap that will be left when this, when the Institute departs?
Yeah, so what are the city's concerns, though, in allowing more screenings to you?
Well, the feedback we've received so far is that they're actually very supportive of it. So we are hopeful that it will be a very positive conversation this evening. You know, again, the conditional use permit for the building did have that restriction because they didn't want it to be, you know, commercial theater, but also they want to make sure that other organizations have access to it, right? This, the auditorium wasn't just built for us. And certainly that's something that we share. Again, we do a lot of things in partnerships with other nonprofit organizations, and we keep hearing from other organizations like, hey, we want to bring in a film. Can you partner with us? Can we partner with you? You know, how can you help us do this? I mean, that's, you know, that's our jam. That's our area of expertise, and we're always happy to work with folks. So, you know, we certainly have consideration for that, but it's really that to make sure that it's not, that it's accessible to other organizations as well as Park City Film, and certainly we share that interest. I mean, we are part of the community and want to make sure that, that theater, that auditorium gets used as much as possible, you know, to its highest and best use.
Yeah. And are you responsible for all of the cleanup, restrooms, the auditorium, the community?
That's part of our lease. So we pay rent, you know, to the city, about $27,000 a year, and that covers janitorial costs.
Okay. So that fee could go up is if you do expand.
Well, the city is asking not, or the library rather, who is kind of in charge of our lease, is asking that that fee not be increased. We are the, you know, the only tenant in that building that does pay rent for our space. And so it doesn't, as part of the costs of doing business, the janitorial staff cleans the whole space every day anyway. So it actually doesn't add anything extra to have them clean the auditorium because they're doing it as a matter of course. But it's something that, you know, in the notes that you'll see for the council meeting tonight, that they'll keep an eye on it. If there is an increase in costs because of our increased screening, then we'll have you'll come back and have another conversation about that.
Okay, that's happening tonight at the Park City Council meeting. What time are you up for discussion?
So the meeting starts at 5:30. We are somewhat in the middle of the agenda. My expectation is that we'll be on around 6:30. If folks want to tune in or, you know, come over and say a few words, kind words about us, we always appreciate that. I've had lots of emails from people, which I appreciate, of like, how can we help? Like, you can email council beforehand. You can tune in on Zoom. You can certainly show up and speak during public comment, you know, show your support for this increase in our screenings. So I think we'll be on at 6:30, but then I've also talked to city staff, and they say, you know, it really just depends on how long the agenda items take before us. So But yeah, it all starts at 5:30, and then you can kind of follow along if you're following along online and kind of see where we are.
Okay. Katie, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you so much. ParkCityFilm.org for screenings. We'll see you at the movies and maybe tonight.
Okay. It's Katie Wang, Executive Director of Park City Film.